welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. A great novel is as multi-layered, as colorful, as compelling, as an exquisite painting. Today, the Book Report looks at recent works by masters, old and new. The genre is thrillers, and the works are as varied as the buzzy new James Bond book, with original, never-before-published material from Bond creator Ian Fleming, to two new takes on the Sherlock Holmes saga, including one from an author who was a star on and off the court. My guest today, Lee Child, is just out with Make Me, number 20 in the wildly popular Jack Reacher series. This one is ever so dark and compelling. I read the entire book in two sittings. It's that good. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the Book Report. The name is Bond. James Bond, and he's back. Anthony Horowitz's Trigger Mortis returns 007 to his 1950s heyday. Mr. Bond has just returned from his Fort Knox showdown with Auric Goldfinger. By his side is the one, the only, Pussy Galore. As they settle down in London, the odds of Galore taming the debonair bachelor seem slim. But she herself is a creature not so easily caught. Meanwhile, the struggles between the Soviet Union and the West are escalating. Smirsch plans to sabotage an international Grand Prix in West Germany. To derail the plot, Bond must play a high-speed game of cat and mouse. When he observes a secretive meeting between Smirsch's driver and a notorious Korean millionaire, it becomes clear this is just an opening move in a deadly game. Bond uncovers a plan that leads first to Florida, then to New York, where a heart-stopping face-off will determine the fate of the West. David Oyelowo performs the book.
At the time, German rocket research was already well advanced, for although the much-hated Treaty of Versailles had placed huge restrictions on the development of weapons, space travel had been excluded. This played into the hands of the German military, who quickly realized that liquid-fueled rockets launched from fairly simple makeshift platforms could travel further and faster than any artillery weapon, delivering their payload into every major city in Europe. Keller was 36 when he met the man in charge of the German space program, the rocket engineer and SS-Sturmbannführer, Werner von Braun. The son of a Prussian baron, von Braun came from a family that had been fighting battles since the 13th century, and he had never lost his aristocratic streak. He strutted into rooms, snapped at anyone who argued with him, and could be coldly dismissive when he was in a certain mood. At the same time, he was utterly dedicated to his work, demanding the best of himself and everyone around him. Keller feared and admired him in equal measure. Of course, by this time, a certain Austrian corporal had come to power and Germany was at war. But none of this particularly interested Keller. Like many of the academics and physicists who were his only friends, he had little interest in the world around him, and if Hitler was going to plow funds, 11 million Deutschmarks appropriated from the Luftwaffe and the army, into rocket-powered interceptors and ballistic missiles, he could happily turn a blind eye to the Nazis' other less savory preoccupations. Indeed, he finally stood at Peenemünde with the first V-2 rockets being launched in the summer of 1944. He never considered the death and devastation that they would bring with their one-ton payloads. He was an artist, and this was his canvas. Watching the launches was for him a moment of pure ecstasy. The clouds of white smoke filled with tiny sparks from the igniter that suddenly rushed together into a brilliant red flame, the cables falling away and the sleek, elegant creature being released into the sky. The vibrations coursed through him. His entire skin seemed to come alive, and he felt the thrill of knowing that he was one of the handful of technicians who had helped in its creation, that the motors would produce an astonishing 800,000 horsepower, and that the rocket would soon achieve 5 times the speed of sound. The citizens of London would have no idea of the perfection, the sheer genius of the weapon that killed them. Often Keller couldn't help himself. He wept tears of pure joy. The war ended, and for a brief time, Keller wondered if he might have to face up to certain repercussions. He had actually been present when von Braun surrendered to the Americans and had subsequently been interrogated by them as part of the famous Blacklist, the code name for German scientists and engineers of special importance. But he wasn't too worried. What von Braun and his team had created would be too valuable to the Allies, and he was confident that somehow their work would continue. He was right. The two men were released from custody on the same day. Along with another dozen scientists and technicians, they were flown out of Germany on the same plane, finally arriving at Fort Bliss, an American army base near El Paso, where, with new masters and, in a few cases, new identities, they continued their work exactly where they had stopped before they were so rudely interrupted. Keller was 50 now and nearing the end of his career. He had lived in the United States for 12 years, but nobody would ever have mistaken him for an American.
We've just heard Trigger Mortis by Anthony Horowitz. Lee Child was born in Coventry, England, but spent his formative years in nearby Birmingham. By coincidence, he won a scholarship to the same high school that J.R.R. Tolkien had attended. Lee went to law school in Sheffield, but after part-time work in theater, he joined Granada TV in Manchester for what turned out to be an 18-year career as a presentation director during British TV's Golden Age. Next on Lee's career path was a decision to buy $6 worth of paper and pencils. He sat down, got down to it, and wrote The Killing Floor, the first in the Jack Reacher series. The book was an immediate success and launched the incredibly popular series. Lee now splits his time between his apartment in Manhattan, country homes in England and the south of France, and whatever airplane cabin he happens to be in while traveling between them. Today we'll speak with Lee about number 20 in the Reacher series, Make Me. Welcome, Lee. It's wonderful to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Always a pleasure to be with you.
In Make Me, you don't waste a moment. The opening sentences. Moving a guy as big as Kiever wasn't easy. It was like trying to wrestle a king-size mattress off a waterbed. So they buried him close to the house. Wow. Please give us a glimpse into the story of Make Me.
Yeah, well, it starts out with that burial, and of course that then immediately begs the question, who is this guy? Who's burying him? Why did they kill him? What's going on? And that's the basic question that we don't get answered until right at the end of the book. Right after that scene, you see, during that scene, actually, they have a slight problem burying the guy because the train comes by and it's late. They thought they were safe. They thought nobody was going to see what they were doing. But in the distance, a train which is delayed by hours and hours, the train rumbles by. And that's a secondary question. Reacher is on that train. We find that out pretty quickly. Did he see? Did he notice? And again, we don't get that question answered for a long time.
I want to quote Reacher here, and here goes. I travel, I move around, I see things, I go where I want. A few bucks in my pocket and 4 points on the compass. Now, we're all familiar with gap years. Some folks take time off to recharge and re-energize, to find themselves. But what is it in Reacher's history that makes him absolutely incapable of staying put, of making a commitment?
Well, he was a military kid. You know, his dad was a Marine officer, and therefore he grew up with his brother on one base after another in all parts of the world, sometimes, you know, maybe Germany, sometimes the Pacific, back in America sometimes. So he's been on the move all the time. He went to dozens of different schools. He never spent more than 2 or 3 months in the same place. And then he was serving himself in the Army. Same thing. He was here, there, everywhere. Now he's out of the Army. And he thought he would just spend a year catching up on what he had not had time to see before, all the various sites and the tourist things. He thought he would go and check a few things out. And I guess he assumed, after a year or so, he would find something to do. But he never has. He just can't break that habit. He doesn't want to stay in one place. He doesn't want to commit. He's just addicted to the open road.
You call him an instinctive brawler, and that was even before his army training. Isn't that right?
Yeah, as a kid, he just had something in his DNA that made him a fighter. You know, instead of backing away from a problem, he steps up and faces it. And I think there are people like that, and he's one of them, and that has had a big effect on his life. It influenced his career, and of course now it influences what he does if he's faced with a problem.
Your dialogue writing seems so natural. I've always wondered why this phrase, "Reacher said nothing," shows up kind of often. Is this a way that you're asking the reader to fill in the blanks?
Well, it's a way of kind of punctuating the rhythm, and it's also a way of emphasizing this is a guy who doesn't say things just for the sake of it. You know, he's quite comfortable with remaining quiet, and in some books he says, you know, he's capable of going days without saying a word. He's comfortable in his own skin. He won't say anything just for the sake of it. He won't say something until he's got something worth saying.
You're a writer and a communicator. Do you feel that way sometimes?
Yeah, I think silence is a really good thing. I think that, and we can see it all around us, I think, you know, with politicians or whatever, sometimes it's better to say nothing rather than say something stupid.
This is not any kind of a spoiler in the book, but Reacher gets a bit hurt in this novel. That's a departure for him. Why now?
Well, partly because I don't want to do the same book every year. I think, you know, we've got to have a bit of variation. And also, I think we've got to have a bit of reality. I mean, although Reacher is fundamentally a kind of mythic and legendary type of character, we've got to introduce reality. And, you know, this is the 20th book. He's had lots of fights. He's been in lots of scrapes. Sooner or later, he's going to get hurt. And in this book, yeah, he takes a blow to the head. He ends up with a headache. The woman he's with is a little worried about his condition, which adds to the characterization. Instead of just him worrying about her, now she's worrying about him, and they're moving forward together.
We're speaking with Lee Child on The Book Report. Tell us about the deep web.
Yeah, that was something that I got into thinking about, and the principle is that, you know, if you were to do a Google search for me or for you, for instance, it would come up with loads of different references. But the point is, you've got to work quite hard to get those references up there. You know, there's a whole skill set in being head of the list or being on page one of the results. And equally, if you want to avoid detection, you just don't do that work, or you make sure that nobody will ever find you. And because we can never be sure what's down there, we don't know how big the deep web is, but some people say it could be 10 times bigger than the surface web. All kinds of things going on down there, mostly criminal activity, hidden from sight. And, you know, there's always a flip side to everything, and the internet is great for a lot of people, and yet there is this dark aspect to it.
What exactly is TOR?
TOR is a sort of search engine or a language that they use down there. It's called the Onion Router. Onion being a reference to the fact that it's got many, many layers. And that is what powers the deep web. That's what keeps all this stuff secret. And ironically, it was invented by the U.S. government. They invented this kind of secret web so that whistleblowers or political dissidents from around the world could have a place to communicate. And of course, it got co-opted and used for bad purposes.
The villains in Make Me are, in my opinion, among the darkest in your series. What was your inspiration for their dastardly plans?
I just thought, you know, what is the worst thing can happen? And the whole theme of the book is that you think it's one thing. You know, you end up thinking that a big surprise happens at the end, and you think that's the answer, but then Reacher is saying, no, there's got to be more than this, and sure enough, then there's another big surprise that reveals the actual truth. And, you know, I have no specific knowledge of it, but I think I'm pretty sure that this stuff really happens, and because that's how life is these days. You can't make this stuff up. You know, whatever you imagine will be happening somewhere in the world.
Well, of course you have fans around the world, but what is it like to have the adoration of an author like Stephen King, who you recently appeared with at Harvard?
Yeah, well, that was completely surreal because, of course, I've been reading him for however long it is now. What is it, like 30, 40 years? I've been reading him, and he's just a great storyteller and a very interesting guy, clearly, you know, with this amazing imagination. And to be on the same stage as him was like a dream come true. It's just one example of the amazing things that can happen as a writer.
Do you ever think to spend time on a standalone novel in between the Reacher novels?
I kind of do. You know, there's a lot of ideas that I would like to pursue, and there's a lot of themes that I would like to explore. But I fundamentally believe entertainment is a two-way street. You know, you give people what they want, and people want the next Reacher story. I think it would be kind of perverse if I said, you know what, I'm not going to give it to you. I'm going to give you this other thing. And I think that however good that book might be, it would kind of start out with two strikes against it. People would be unhappy that Reacher wasn't in it.
So any final thoughts about Make Me?
I just hope people really enjoy reading it and it gives them a good few days. And, you know, I hope the big surprise at the end doesn't upset them too much.
Well, it was dark, but it was a fabulous read. I read it in two sittings. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, and absolutely. Good to be with you.
Alrighty. Bye now.
Bye.
And now, let's listen to a sample of Make Me, performed by Dick Hill.
Reacher stood still, and behind him the train moved away without him, straining, grinding, settling to a slow rat-a-tat rhythm, and then accelerating, its building slipstream pulling at his clothes. He was the only passenger who had gotten out, which was not surprising. The place was no kind of a commuter hub. It was all agricultural. What token passenger facilities it had were wedged between the last elevator and the huge shed, and were limited to a compact building which seemed to have both a ticket window and benches for waiting. It was built in a traditional railroad style, and it looked like a child's toy, temporarily set down between two shiny oil drums. But on a signboard running its whole length was written the reason Reacher was there. Mother's Rest, which he had seen on a map, and which he thought was a great name for a railroad stop. He figured the line must cross an ancient wagon train trail right there, where something had happened long ago. Maybe a young pregnant woman went into labor. The jostling could not have helped. Maybe the wagon train stopped for a couple of weeks, or a month. Maybe someone remembered the place years later. A descendant, perhaps, a family legend. Maybe there was a one-room museum. Or perhaps there was a sadder interpretation. Maybe they had buried a woman there, too old to make it, in which case there would be a commemorative stone. Either way, Reacher figured he might as well find out. He had no place to go, and all the time in the world to get there, so detours cost him nothing, which is why he got out of the train. To a sense of disappointment, initially, his expectations had been way off base. He had pictured a couple of dusty houses and a lonely one-horse corral and the one-room museum, maybe run part-time and volunteer by an old guy from one of the houses, or the headstone, maybe marble, behind a square wrought-iron fence. He had not expected the immense agricultural infrastructure. He should have, he supposed. Grain meet the railroad. It had to be loaded somewhere. Billions of bushels and millions of tons each year. He stepped left and looked through a gap between structures. The view was dark, but he could sense a rough semicircle of habitation. Houses, obviously, for the depot workers. He could see lights, which he hoped were a motel, or a diner, or both. He walked to the exit, skirting the pools of vapor light purely out of habit, but he saw that the last lamp was unavoidable because it was set directly above the exit gate. So he saved himself a further perimeter diversion by walking through the next-to-last pool of light, too, at which point a woman stepped out of the shadows. She came toward him with a distinctive burst of energy, two fast paces, eager, like she was pleased to see him. Her body language was all about relief.
That was Make Me by Lee Child. In a first-time collaboration, Queen of Suspense, Mary Higgins Clark, partners with best-selling author Alifair Burke in The Cinderella Murder. Producer Lori Moran is delighted with her successful pilot, Under Suspicion, a cold case reality series that revisits unsolved crimes by recreating them with those affected. Next episode up on Lori's show is The Cinderella Murder. When Susan Dempsey, a beautiful UCLA student, was found dead, her murder raised numerous questions. Why was her car parked miles from the body? Had she ever shown up for an acting audition she'd scheduled with an up-and-coming director? Why does Susan's boyfriend want to avoid being questioned? Are there links between Susan's roommate's infatuation with a New Age religious sect and her disappearance? What was Susan's relationship with her computer science professor? With a case that spotlights both Hollywood's elite and tech billionaires, Lori is sure of great viewership. But is Cinderella's murderer ready for a close-up? If you get hooked on this adventure, performed by Jan Maxwell, book two from this dynamic duo will be out in mid-November.
Lori Moran paused on her way to her office at 15 Rockefeller Center to admire the ocean of gold and red tulips blooming in the Channel Gardens. Named after the English Channel because they separated the French and British Empire buildings, these gardens were always brimming with something lush and cheerful. Tulips were no match for the plaza's Christmas tree, but the discovery of new plantings every few weeks in spring always made it easier for Lori to say goodbye to her favorite season in the city. While other New Yorkers complained about the throngs of holiday tourists, Lori found cheer in the brisk air and festive decorations. Outside the Lego store, a father was photographing his son next to the giant Lego dinosaur. Her own son, Timmy, always had to loop through the store to inspect the latest creations when he visited her at work.
"How long do you think it took them to make this, Dad? How many pieces do you think there are?"
The boy looked up at his father with a certainty that he had all the answers in the world. Lori felt a pang of sadness, remembering the way Timmy used to gaze at Greg with the same anticipatory awe. The father noticed her watching, and she turned away.
"Excuse me, miss, but would you mind taking our picture?"
37 years old, Lori had learned long ago that she came across as friendly and approachable. Slender with honey-colored hair and clear hazel eyes, she was typically described as good-looking and classy. She wore her hair in a simple shoulder-length bob and rarely bothered with makeup. She was attractive but unthreatening. She was the type of woman people stop for directions, or, as in this case, amateur photography.
"Of course I don't mind," she said.
The man handed her his phone.
"These gadgets are great, but all our family pictures are from an arm's length away. It would be nice to have something to show besides a bunch of selfies."
He pulled his son in front of him as she stepped back to get the entire dinosaur in view.
"Say cheese," she urged.
They complied, flashing big, toothy smiles.
"Father and son," Lori thought wistfully.
The father thanked Lori as she returned his phone.
"We didn't expect New Yorkers to be so nice."
"I promise, most of us are pretty nice," Lori assured him.
"Ask New Yorkers for directions, and 9 out of 10 will take the time."
Lori smiled, thinking of the day when she was crossing Rockefeller Center with Donna Hanover, the former First Lady of New York City. A tourist had touched Donna's arm and asked if she knew her way around New York. Donna had turned and pointed and explained,
"You're just a couple blocks from..."
Smiling at the memory, Lori crossed the street and entered the Fisher Blake Studios offices. She got off the elevator on the 25th floor and hurried to her office. Grace Garcia and Jerry Klein were already busy at their cubicles. When Grace saw Lori, she sprang up from her seat first.
Hi, Lori.
Grace was Lori's 26-year-old assistant. As usual, her heart-shaped face was heavily but perfectly made up. Today, her ever-changing mane of long, jet-black hair was pulled into a tight ponytail. She wore a bright blue mini-dress with black tights and stiletto boots that would have sent Lori toppling over face first. Jerry, wearing one of his trademark cardigan sweaters, ambled from his seat to follow Lori into her private office. Despite Grace's sky-high heels, long, lanky Jerry loomed over her. He was only 1 year older than Grace, but had been with the company since he was in college, working his way up from intern to valued production assistant, and had just been promoted to assistant producer. If it hadn't been for Grace and Jerry's dedication, Lori never could have gotten her show, Under Suspicion, off the ground.
What's going on? Lori asked. You two act like there's a surprise party waiting in my office.
You could put it that way, Jerry said, but the surprise isn't in your office.
It's in here, Grace said, handing Lori a legal-sized mailing envelope. The return address read, Rosemary Dempsey, Oakland, California. The seal had been opened.
Sorry, but we peeked.
And?
She agreed, Jerry blurted excitedly.
That was The Cinderella Murder by Mary Higgins Clark and Alifair Burke. Top secret data has been stolen from the CIA, and the only man who knows its hiding place is dead. CIA operative Mitch Rapp must race to find the classified information in Vince Flynn's The Survivor, the book that picks up where the last man left off. Joseph Rick Rickman, former boy wonder at the CIA, stole a massive amount of top secret and highly compromising intel concerning international classified ops. Then he offered it to the Pakistani secret forces. His plans go awry when CIA Director Irene Kennedy sent Rapp to hunt him down. But it turns out killing Rickman did not solve the problem. Rickman stored the devastating data somewhere only he knew, and somehow, from beyond the grave, he poses a mortal threat. George Goodall narrates.
Coleman had to admit that he'd been a little irritated when a woman who reminded him of his mother showed up at his company's nondescript door to thank him not only for the job, but for the generous mental health benefits. As usual, though, Rapp had been right. Bibi was worth her considerable weight in gold. Coleman glanced at a second screen that displayed a satellite image of Istanbul with a single blue dot representing Bibi's position. It suddenly took a hard left and started down a set of stairs toward the waterfront.
Okay, Joe, she's turned east and we're going to lose her. Can we close in?
Old lady gets around, Maslick said, grudging respect audible beneath his irritation at having to wade back into city traffic. Coleman smiled as they pulled away from the curb. His men were all former special forces, primarily SEALs, Delta, and Recon Marines. With the right set of support hose, though, it was possible that Bibi could run them all into the ground. He wedged a foot against his state-of-the-art electronics to keep them from shifting as the van struggled up a rain-slickened hill. On the main monitor, Bibi's camera swept briefly across the man they were following. He wasn't much to look at. 5'8", a slight Asian tilt to his features, and a mediocre suit pulled close against the rain. In reality, though, Vasily Zhutov was the CIA's highest-placed mole in the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. Codenamed Sitting Bull, he was among the agency's most clandestine and hard-won assets. The problem was that no one was sure if his identity was still a secret. Worse, it wasn't just his cover that had potentially been blown. It was the cover of virtually every CIA asset recruited in the last quarter century. Teams like Coleman's had been deployed across the globe, spread way too thin to do any more than make educated guesses as to who might be targeted. And it was all because of one man, the late Joseph Rick Rickman. Rickman had been stationed in Jalalabad for the last 8 years and had pretty much run the CIA's side of the war in Afghanistan. Word was that he had an IQ just north of 200 and based on Coleman's interactions with the man, he had no reason to dispute that figure. The better part of $1 billion had flowed through Rickman's hands over the years, funding weapons purchases, bribes to local politicians, and God knew what else. Rick had a relationship with virtually every player in the country, and had an uncanny ability to track the complex forces tearing the region apart. If asked about the economic effect of the heroin trade on the insurgency, he could lecture like a Harvard PhD. Conversely, asked about some minor family dispute between two mountain villages no one had ever heard of, he'd speak with equal authority. The only person at the agency who could even hope to keep up with what was going on in that man's head was Irene Kennedy, and she had too many other things on her plate to try. Unfortunately, the house of cards Rickman had built all came crashing down the previous month when he completely lost his mind. Whether it was the pressure of the job, family problems, or just the chaos and hopelessness of Afghanistan, no one knew. What they did know, though, was that Rickman had hatched a plot with Akhtar Durrani, the deputy general of Pakistan's ISI, to betray the CIA and the people Rickman had fought with for his entire career. Rickman had killed his bodyguards and faked his own kidnapping, going so far as to release a gut-wrenching video of himself being tortured by two men posing as Muslim extremists. It had been like setting off a bomb in the U.S. intelligence community. With his incredible intellect and decades of CIA ops under his belt, there was no way for anyone to know what information he was privy to and how much of it he'd give up when the hot pokers came out. Panic ensued, with countless undercover assets requesting extraction, demanding asylum at U.S. embassies, and generally drawing a lot of unwanted attention to America's spy network. During his faked interrogation, Rickman had blurted out a number of names, but one in particular had generated a wave of dread in Langley. Sitting Bull. Russia hadn't been Rick's theater of operation, and the identity of the man was one of the CIA's most closely held secrets. Was it a red herring? Nothing more than a couple of meaningless words he'd overheard and socked away in that magnificent brain of his? Or had he actually gotten hold of enough information to compromise the Russian?
That was The Survivor by Vince Flynn with Kyle Mills. In 1914, collisions between motor cars and horse-drawn carriages were a regular occurrence in Paterson, New Jersey. But when an out-of-control driver smashes into a buggy with Constance, Norma, and Florette Kopp on board, their lives change forever. Constance, the eldest, demands payment for the damages. But she quickly realizes she's dealing with a crazy man. Henry Kaufman is a silk manufacturer with a drinking problem and a dangerous group of associates. Soon the Kopp home is under siege. The sisters face threats of arson, kidnapping, and white slavery. When the sheriff can't resolve the case, he issues revolvers to the Kopp sisters, posts guards at their door, and enlists Constance's help in catching Kaufman. In the process, Constance is pulled into an underworld of abused factory workers, missing children, and dirty dealings. Before the collision, Constance was a bored 35-year-old living in home, stuck in a life she didn't want. The minute Constance was issued a gun, she found her calling. Set against the backdrop of the famous Paterson Silk Strike and based on actual events, Amy Stewart's Girl Waits with Gun is the first in a series of novels based on the real-life adventures of Constance, Norma, and Florette Kopp. Drawing on newspaper reports, courthouse files, and letters, this intriguing story remains true to the historical record. Christina Moore narrates.
The butcher and a couple of men from the print shop, their hands black with ink, helped us raise the wagon just enough to allow Florette to slide clear of the wheel. As we lifted the broken panels off her, Florette stared up at us with wild, dark eyes. She wore a dress sheathed in pink taffeta. Against the dusty road, she looked like a trampled bed of roses. "Don't move," I whispered, bending over her. But she got her arms underneath herself and sat up. "No, no, no," said one of the printers. "We'll call for a doctor." I looked up at the men standing in a circle around us. "She'll be fine," I said, sliding a hand over her ankle. "Go on." Some of those men looked a little too eager to help with the examination of Florette's legs. They shuffled off to help two livery drivers who had disembarked from their own wagons to tend to our mare. They freed her from the harness, and she struggled to stand. The poor creature groaned and tossed her head and blew steam from her nostrils. The drivers fed her something from their pockets, and that seemed to settle her. I gave Florette's calf a squeeze. She howled and jerked away from me. "Is it broken?" she asked. I couldn't say. "Try to move it." She screwed her face into a knot, held her breath, and gingerly bent one leg and then the other. When she was finished, she let her breath go all at once and looked up at me, panting. "That's good," I said. "Now move your ankles and your toes." We both looked down at her feet. She was wearing the most ridiculous white calfskin boots with pink ribbons for laces. "Are they all right?" she asked. I put my hand on her back to steady her. "Just try to move them. First your ankle." "I meant the boots!" That's when I knew Florette would survive. I unlaced the boots and promised to look after them. A much larger crowd had gathered, and Florette wiggled her pale stockinged toes for her new audience. "You'll have quite a bruise tomorrow, miss," said a lady behind us. The seat that had trapped me a few moments ago was resting on the ground. I helped Florette into it and took another look at her legs. Her stockings were torn, and she was scratched and bruised, but not broken to bits, as I'd feared. I offered my handkerchief to press against one long and shallow cut along her ankle, but she'd already lost interest in her own injuries. "Look at Norma," she whispered with a wicked little smile. My sister had planted herself directly in the path of the motor car to prevent the men from driving away. She did make a comical sight, a small but stocky figure in her split riding skirt of drab cotton. Norma had the broad Slavic face and thick nose of our father, and our mother's sour disposition. Her mouth was set in a permanent frown, and she looked on everyone with suspicion. She stared down the driver of the motor car with the kind of flat-footed resolve that came naturally to her in times of calamity. The automobilist was a short but solidly built young man who had an overfed look about him, hinting at a privileged life. He would have been handsome if not for an indolent and spoiled aspect about his eyes and the tough set of his mouth, which suggested he was accustomed to getting his way. His face was puffy and red from the heat, but also, I suspected, from a habit of putting away a quart of beer at breakfast and a bottle of wine at night. He was dressed exceedingly well, in striped linen trousers, a silk waistcoat with polished brass buttons, and a tie as red as the blood seeping through Florette's stockings. His companions tumbled out of the car and gathered around him as if standing guard. They wore the plain broadcloth suits of working men and carried themselves like rats who weren't accustomed to being spotted in the daylight. Each of them was unkempt and unshaven, and a few kept their hands in their pockets in a manner that suggested they might be reaching for their knives. I couldn't imagine where this gang of ruffians had been off to in such a hurry, but I was already beginning to regret that we had been the ones to get in their way.
We've just heard "Girl Waits with a Gun" by Amy Stewart. Thanks to heartthrob Benedict Cumberbatch, many of us continue to be intrigued by Sherlock Holmes. Let's finish today's book report with two fabulous new takes on the Holmes story. The first is "Moriarty" by Anthony Horowitz. Sherlock is dead. Days after Holmes and his arch-enemy Moriarty fall to their doom at Reichenbach Falls, Pinkerton agent Frederick Chase arrives in Europe from New York. The death of Moriarty has created a poisonous vacuum, which has swiftly been filled by a fiendish new criminal. Assisted by Inspector Jones of Scotland Yard, a devoted student of Holmes' methods of investigation and deduction, Chase must forge a path through the darkest corners of the capital to shine light on this shadowy figure. The book is read by Julian Rind Tutt.
My appearance? Well, It's never easy for a man to describe himself, but I will be honest and say that I could not call myself handsome. My hair was black, my eyes an indifferent shade of brown. I was slender, and though only in my 40s, I was already too put upon by the challenges life had thrown my way. I was unmarried, and sometimes I worried that it showed in my wardrobe, which was perhaps a little too well worn. If there were a dozen men in the room, I would be the last to speak. That was my nature. I was at Reichenbach 5 days after the confrontation that the world has come to know was the final problem. Well, there was nothing final about it, as we now know, and I guess that just leaves us with the problem. So, let's take it from the start. Sherlock Holmes, the greatest consulting detective who ever lived, flees England in fear of his life. Dr. Watson, who knows the man better than anyone and who would never hear a word said against him, is forced to admit that this time Holmes is at less than his best, utterly worn out by the predicament in which he finds himself and which he cannot control. Can we blame him? He has been attacked no fewer than 3 times in the space of just 1 morning. He has come within an inch of being crushed by a 2-horse van that rushes past him on Welbeck Street. He has almost been hit by a brick that falls, or is thrown, from a roof on Vere Street. And right outside Watson's front door, he finds himself attacked by some good fellow who's been waiting with a bludgeon. Does he have any choice but to flee? Well, yes. There are so many other choices available to him that I have to wonder what exactly was in Mr. Holmes's mind. Not, of course, that he's particularly forthcoming in the stories, all of which I've read, without everyone's guessing the solution for what it's worth. To begin with, what makes him think he will be safer on the continent than he will be closer to home? London itself is a densely knit, teeming city, which he knows intimately, and, as he once confided, he has many rooms. 5 small refuges, Watson says, scattered around the place, which are known only to him. He could disguise himself. In fact, he does disguise himself. Only the next day, after Watson has arrived at Victoria Station, he notices an aged Italian priest in discussion with a porter, and even goes so far as to offer him his assistance. Later, the priest enters his carriage, and the two of them sit together face to face for several minutes before Watson recognizes his friend. Holmes's disguises were so brilliant that he could have spent the next 3 years as a Catholic priest without anyone being the wiser. He could have entered an Italian monastery, Padre Sherlock. That would have thrown his enemies. They might even have let him pursue some of his other interests, beekeeping, for example, on the side. Instead, Holmes goes herring off on a journey that seems to have nothing that resembles an itinerary, and he asks Watson to accompany him. Why? The most incompetent criminal will surely work out that where one goes, the other will quite probably follow. And let's not forget that we are talking here about a criminal like no other, the master of his profession, a man who is equally feared and admired by Holmes himself. I don't believe for a minute that he could possibly have underestimated Moriarty. Common sense tells me that he must have been playing another game. Sherlock Holmes travels to Canterbury, New Haven, Brussels, and Strasbourg, followed every step of the way. At Strasbourg, he receives a telegram from the London police informing him that all the members of Moriarty's gang have been captured. This is, as it turns out, quite false. One key player has slipped through the net. Although I use the term ill-advisedly, as the big fat fish that is Colonel Sebastian Moran has never been anywhere near it.
That was Moriarty by Anthony Horowitz. To quote Sherlock himself, "When I say, therefore, that my brother has better powers of observation than I am speaking the exact and literal truth." Critics will tell you a new addition to the Mycroft Holmes saga by a very famous author and celebrity is a slam dunk. Intrigued? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar has just created a new story about Mycroft Holmes. Had you even realized that Kareem is a mad, passionate Holmesian? In this story, Mycroft, a Cambridge graduate, assists the Secretary of State and becomes embroiled in a mystery in Trinidad, an adventure based on actual history. Anna Waterhouse, a professional screenwriter and script consultant, co-authors the book. Damien Lynch narrates.
It was the sort of place where smallpox and fevers took hold and never let go, where toothless hawkers extolled the virtues of flowers that proper housewives had discarded days before, while other hawkers, with no virtue left to extol, sold their own wilted bodies to any passing stranger. Whatever else it was, St. Giles wasn't fit for fine gentlemen with overpriced topcoats. Once a person found himself at St. Giles, it was best to tread lightly and to hold on to his wits and his wallet with equal vigour. As Cyrus Douglas began his slow ascent back to consciousness, the first thing he smelled was St. Giles in all its damnable glory. And the first thing he heard was the echoing sound of Abby's hooves thundering down the broken, battered street as he and Holmes jostled violently from side to side at a pace that threatened to send them both tumbling over Turkey. "What the bloody deuce are you doing, Holmes?" he tried to say aloud, though he still couldn't find his voice. "Are you determined to get us killed?" Then he heard another sound, one that froze his blood. It was the pounding hoofbeats of their pursuers, mingled with jeers and laughing. Holmes must have taken a wrong and fatal turn, Douglas thought. But, rather than speed up, he was slowing Abby down to little more than a trot. All the while, the sounds were coming closer. "Faster, Holmes," he thought frantically, though he still could not speak. "Faster, for the love of all that is holy." Perversely, he could feel his friend pulling back on the reins, actually slowing their pace. It was such a mad choice that even Abby seemed reluctant to comply. "Easy, boy, easy," Holmes repeated. The thugs were so very near that Douglas was certain he could feel their breath at the back of his neck. He dared to glance behind, and immediately wished he hadn't. The villains had their sticks and whips and bottles raised high into the air. Those same mean weapons with which they beat their poor nags, they now planned to use on their unarmed quarry. And with the blow to his temple still so fresh and throbbing, Douglas was in no condition to fight. There would be little for him to do but roll up into a ball, take the blows, and hope that death came quickly. A murder of crows, ragged and cawing, swooped down upon them. As if they were some celestial signal, Holmes suddenly prodded Abby into a full gallop until the horse was flying over the gouges and ruts, the bird's caws melding with the men's laughter. They approached a mews that led to nowhere, with carts and makeshift stands and garbage consuming every inch of the street. Yet Holmes continued on, prodding Abby so close to a tenement wall that it nearly scraped the poor thing's side. The pursuers began to ride, two by two, so as to allow no room for escape. Douglas finally unlocked his jaw to speak. "What the deuce are you thinking, Holmes?" Suddenly, above their heads, a half-dozen windows burst open at the same time, and several large, chattering women leaned out, upending enormous buckets of slop onto the street below. The filth missed Abby and his riders by less than a length, but the ruffians behind them barely had time to cry out when they were drenched in a pungent mix of offal, rotting vegetables, bone, gristle. Their beasts skittered on the slime, and the ruts proved lethal. The assailant in the lead, the one with one eyebrow, went hurtling over his nag like a projectile and landed headfirst in a fly-infested, maggot-encrusted dung heap. Others went down hither and thither until all were crawling about in the muck, trying to regain their footing only to slip into it again, all the while cursing loudly. Pulling again on the reins, Holmes turned Abby and trotted him past a confusion of upended horses and men, while the crows nonchalantly swooped over the lot of them, eager to ferret out their breakfast. The sight gave Douglas new vigour, and he resumed the reins. Though they had to pass through a baptism of grime, it was a sprinkling, not the immersion their pursuers had endured. And though Holmes's topcoat and his own were likely ruined, their bodies were more or less intact.
We've just heard Mycroft Holmes by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Anna Waterhouse. readers, reaching for a great mystery when you've got the urge is elementary. With so many titles clamoring for your time and attention, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for suggestions. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.